with specific reference to the Shield of Achilles and the fact that poetry is capturing what the picture captures. This interweaving of poetry and painting, words and pictures, will give us a very good handle for understanding the big issues of the Iliad.
You know, Casey and Mary, I really think that the idea of applying a microcosm as what we've seen in Scroll 18 to the macrocosm of the Iliad would work elsewhere as well. How about Scroll 9?
Scroll 9 of the Iliad, Ajax, Odysseus, and Phoenix go to the tents of Achilles on behalf of Agamemnon to offer him gifts and try to get him to come back to the war. And one of the ways that Phoenix tries to convince Achilles is by telling him a story, which the Greeks would call an ainos, that is, a coded message which you can only decode or get if you're intellectually, morally, and emotionally qualified to do so. Phoenix's story is about a warrior of his generation named Meleager. Meleager becomes angry, that is, he conceives Menes, and he withdraws from battle and stays home. His comrades start sending envoy after envoy to offer him gifts and get him to come back. First they send the elders, then the priests, then his father, and finally his sisters and mothers come, and they accomplish nothing. So then his nearest and dearest companions, his most filoi, as the Greeks would say, come to him and ask him to return, but they're unsuccessful as well. Instead, he stays home with his wife, Cleopatra, and won't go back until finally she sings a lament on behalf of the entire city and moves him enough to get him to return to battle. Now, the superficial message of this story is that Meleager returned to battle too late, and so he never got the gifts that were initially offered to him. But Phoenix is also trying to teach Achilles something about priorities. The people that come to entreat Meleager come in a very specific order, and this is known as the ascending scale of affection. The elders, priests, father, sisters, mother, and companions of Meleager come in what should be an ascending relationship of affection with him. The problem is that Meleager refuses even his nearest and dearest companions, so they're no longer at the top of his ascending scale. Cleopatra has taken the top spot in that ranking, and ultimately it is she that convinces Meleager to come back to battle. What fascinates me about this story is that there are several levels of narrative. First, we have the micro-narrative of the Meleager story. Phoenix tells this story in a macro-narrative in which Achilles has withdrawn from battle and the Greeks are suffering. But there's an outer narrative that encompasses all of this, and that is the Iliad as a whole. The poet can see beyond the immediate context to the time when Achilles finally does rejoin battle. Like Meleager, Achilles is going to refuse those nearest and dearest to him, his companions, in Iliad 9, and he's going to refuse all of their gifts as well. But in Iliad 16, Patroclus, his best friend, comes to him and asks him to rejoin the battle. And like Cleopatra, Meleager's wife, he sings a lament on behalf of the Greeks who are dying. Achilles finally begins to relent. He allows Patroclus to go into battle, leading the Myrmidons and wearing his armor. Patroclus takes Achilles' place. In the ensuing battle, Patroclus gets killed by Hector, and his death brings Achilles back into the war. Just like with the Shield of Achilles, we can make direct connections between the characters in the micro-narrative and the Iliad as a whole. The names of the key figures reveals everything. Cleopatra's name is formed from two parts, Cleos, which means glory or fame, and Patra, which is a word that has to do with ancestors. Patroclus' name is formed from these same two parts, but reversed. Patro plus Kleos. We see that the poet has composed this story and put it into the mouth of Phoenix to convey messages for the Iliad as a whole and events that happen far beyond the immediate context of Iliad 9. And so even Phoenix's agenda are subsumed to the larger themes of the Iliad.
I agree with you. And those larger themes, they can go even beyond the Iliad.
That's right. The Iliad, after all, is the story of Achilles. But as we've already seen from Scrolls 1 and 9, Achilles is sitting out. He's not participating in the Trojan War at this point. And so the action that we hear of between 1 and 9 is technically outside of the story of Achilles. And if we look closely at one scene in Scroll 3, we'll see that it's even outside of the narrative of the supposed 10th year of the Trojan War. So what happens in Scroll 3 is that Paris and Menelaus, the two husbands of Helen, agree to a single duel between the two of them for her. And Helen is brought to the walls of Troy to watch this duel. Our first question when we think about Book 3 is, why would there be a duel in the 10th year of this war? These two armies have been fighting for 10 years, and now they've decided to have a duel. So it logically fits much earlier in the war. But our focus in the Iliad is on the 10th year, the time when Achilles decided to sit out. And so through the process of oral composition, this action can be refolded into what we are now looking at in the 10th year of the war. And we'll see signs of that as well once Helen gets to the walls, where she has a conversation with Priam. And Priam asks her who the various Greek heroes are. Again, we can ask ourselves, why wouldn't Priam already know who the leader of the Greeks are if they've been outside his city and camped there for 10 years? But this is another opportunity for microcosms, micro-narratives about each of these heroes, and gives us a chance to hear about Agamemnon and Odysseus from Helen. Now, the question of why Helen, who describes these heroes, is again an interesting one. Helen, when she comes to the walls here, there's a buzz of excitement. It's literally described as cicadas buzzing around when Helen appears. And the first thing that anyone actually says to her is Priam saying, come and sit with me. I don't blame you for the war. And then he proceeds to ask her about the various Greek heroes. And when Helen describes the Greeks, we hear all sorts of language from her about how she's the cause of the war, it's all her fault, exactly the opposite of what Priam just said to her. So this micro-narrative of Helen and her description of what's going on not only would be prior temporally, before the 10th year of the war, but it also gives a different perspective on what the war is all about. We never hear from anyone else that Helen is shameful, Helen is baneful, Helen isn't worth the war, but that's precisely what Helen says about herself. And to the extent that when she looks out and doesn't see her brothers there fighting on her behalf, she assumes that it's because they're too ashamed of what she's done. But Helen, again, is the only one to ever say that what she's done was wrong. And so looking at just this micro-narrative in Book 3, we can see how the poet can reincorporate stories into his main narrative frame that look not only temporally outside of what's going on in the story of Achilles, but also can give different perspectives on what the action is all about.
I agree, and this would be a perfect transition for us to go to scroll 18.